Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, delivering lunches to Maine's medical workers all this month to thank them for their dedication. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. This year's first budget battle in the legislature is over. Democrats and Republicans have agreed on the supplemental budget in the wee hours of the morning Friday after a week-long stalemate over tax breaks for business. The compromise will allow businesses to receive some tax breaks, but not all of the ones Republicans had originally hoped for. It also tells us where some party priorities lie. Mal, tell us about how that battle ended.
It ended as we see most budget battles in the legislature end, and that is with a compromise at the very last minute. In fact, it looked right up until around 11:30 that there was going to be a real blowout with no budget passed. There was talk of the Democrats passing a simple majority and then adjourning, which would trigger the 90 days when the bill would take effect before the end of the budget year. All that stuff was swirling around, and then they got together and compromised using some money that they had simply because the state's economy is doing better than anyone projected. And we now have a significant revenue surplus that's been growing every month.
So, Mal, tell us a little bit more about exactly what it was that in the end broke this deadlock on this budget bill.
It was the decision by the Republicans to allow the question of a specific tax break on foreign investments. A very specific tax break may affect only a handful of companies in the state of Maine. They put that out to a study instead of actually conforming to the federal treatment of that kind of revenue by corporations. And part of the offset there was taking some of the money out of the unallocated surplus to go to the Rainy Day Fund, or the Budget Stabilization Fund, as it's officially known.
My reading of this compromise, such as it is that it isn't fundamentally different from the budget that Democrats passed exactly a week ago. At the end of the day, more than 28,000 Maine businesses are going to get a double tax benefit on pandemic loans, which is what Democrats agreed to. 160,000 unemployed workers will get some relief on unemployment benefits that they received. Again, Democrats passed that last week. The fundamental difference here is that this $8 million is going to go to the Rainy Day Fund, which it may have ended up there anyway because it was part of a surplus.
So what did they do with some of that extra money to resolve this?
Well, that's the way they came up with, for example, the $8 million to go into the Rainy Day Fund. It was there because it's in the what's called the unallocated surplus, because they know the unallocated surplus is going to grow when the Revenue Forecasting Committee reprojects revenues here in a few weeks.
This was a standoff that, you know, Republicans wanted to have over these obscure tax breaks that may have only benefited, you know, a handful of businesses, less than 10, at least according to the state's finance office.
So maybe the real purpose was just kind of a shot across the bow ahead of the two-year budget discussion.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what it was. That I think Republicans wanted to prove that they're not going to get rolled over in the budget negotiations for the two-year budget. This is where they took their stand. I think the reason why there's a compromise is that they realize that these two obscure tax breaks are not necessarily ones that the public is going to support. Going for those tax breaks would have risked the tax breaks for the 28,000 Maine businesses that are actually located here. Some of the ones that would have received this other benefit are not.
Well, the latest federal pandemic aid package, now law, passed by Congress without a single Republican vote, signed by President Biden. The lack of bipartisan support for this measure was not for an absolute lack of effort. Steve, I was talking to a Republican congressional staffer who told me, in addition to that much publicized meeting in which Senator Susan Collins and 9 other GOP Senate colleagues presented their $600 billion alternative, there were a few other exchanges before Democrats decided to go ahead on their own. And I take it, Steve, there's some history behind all of that.
Yeah, Erwin, there is. It really goes back to the Obama administration as it was pushing for a stimulus package to help Americans during the Great Recession. And if you recall, there was a lot of outreach by Obama and Democrats to try and make sure that that proposal was bipartisan. It meant a lot to the Obama administration in particular. Now, a lot of that outreach was actually directed at Republicans like Senator Susan Collins, who ultimately voted for the plan. The problem, as Democrats now see it, is that those concessions to garner GOP support ultimately hurt the 2009 stimulus bill, because they believe that it prolonged the nation's economic recovery to the point that it actually hurt Democrats in the subsequent midterm elections. Well, the Biden administration was not going to make that same mistake. Remember that this bill became law only because Democrats used a parliamentary device known as budget reconciliation to steer this thing past the filibuster in the Senate. And that's because Democrats only have 50 votes in the Senate and you need 60. And, you know, this is one of those instances where there's just not going to be that many opportunities to use this process again. And so I think Democrats were like, well, this is our chance. So we've got to put some stuff in here that we may not be able to get passed on its own. Perhaps they're recognizing that this is their one opportunity to get a few of their other policy initiatives enacted.
And I think it's pretty obvious that many of their initiatives are either going to have to be compromised on or they're not going to get through. For example, the minimum wage increase, which the Senate parliamentarian ruled out of order on this budget bill, is going to come up again. It's going to take 60 votes to end debate in the Senate. I don't think you're going to get it for $15, but there are a number of senators in both parties, by the way, that say they're willing to support a minimum wage increase of a lesser amount, say $10 an hour or $12 an hour.
Now, the aid package got no Republican support, but it did get Democratic opposition from Maine's 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden. Now, the first time this pandemic aid bill came up, he was one of two Dems to vote no. This time, he was alone. Steve, is Golden going to pay any price among Democratic supporters for this?
Well, Erwin, I think he is at the moment, rhetorically. He's definitely taken some hits from Democratic activists. This has happened before, but the backlash here is at a different level. You know, more importantly, I think, is that his opposition to this stimulus bill seems to have angered allied interest groups that have been, up until this point, holding fire. I'm talking specifically about the Maine AFL-CIO, which is a labor organization that called out Golden by name in a press statement this week, you know, right alongside Senator Susan Collins, who also voted against the stimulus. And I think the other reason his no vote has angered so many people on the left is that his arguments against the American Rescue Plan are essentially Republican arguments. It spends too much money. Not enough of it is on direct pandemic relief. The rest is being spent at the wrong time and on the wrong things. To liberals who just plopped a bunch of their legislative priorities into this thing, that sounds a lot like rejection of their policy priorities. Like some arch conservatives have to tolerate some of the votes that Susan Collins takes, some liberals may have to tolerate some of the votes that Jared Golden takes.
There's kind of no place for Democrats to go in the 2nd District.
Well, the 2nd District is more conservative than the 1st by a big margin. Donald Trump took the 2nd District in two elections. So that shows you that it's not the same constituency that, say, Shelley Pingree has in the 1st District. And I think Golden is playing to that group. He was trying to vote the way his constituents wanted, as opposed to the way the Democratic mainstream wanted.
Yeah, and we need to dig into this a little deeper at some point. But I mean, even in that 2nd District, which includes places like Lewiston, those are communities where Donald Trump did not do too badly in the last election, if I'm not mistaken. Well, we had a special legislative election in the last week, not really a big deal in terms of balance of power in the legislature, but nonetheless turned out to be a historic vote.
You know, it wasn't just historic in terms of Senator Hickman becoming the first Black man to serve in both chambers, but, you know, it was so lopsided. I mean, this is a district that broke for Donald Trump in 2016 and then narrowly for President Biden. That means it's a swing district, you know, and certainly in terms of electing state senators, it's the same way. There's been Democrats that have held it. There's been Republicans that have held it. To get clobbered as bad as the Republicans did here does not bode well for them, I think, on a lot of levels. I mean, Craig Hickman won 9 of 11 towns and in convincing fashion, and it held his own in some conservative strongholds like West Gardner. So, you know, that, you know, you don't want to read too much into a special election that was just on the heels of the election we just had. It is certainly got to be worrisome for Republicans, I think, especially since we've heard some chatter from Republican activists that, you know, as William Garrett, who was a Republican in this race, went door to door, a lot of people, all they wanted to talk about was Donald Trump, you know, and talk about Donald Trump and whether, you know, Susan Collins should have been censured for voting to impeach him, you know, or convict him on his impeachment charges. So, you know, if that's what Republican voters are focused on in that district, that does not bode well for down ticket Republicans who are trying to run on other issues. Republicans got to be worried about that, you know, and at the same time, it's a problem of their own making because they have so identified their party with the former president. They're going to have to rethink that a little bit and try to make some room for some other people so that they actually have a chance in swing districts like this one.
Yeah, you mentioned Wes Gardner, one of the 11 towns in that district. This district is mostly towns to the west and slightly to the south of Augusta. All right, Mal, Steve, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. Our podcast is updated each Friday. You can hear and download it from mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Our over-the-air broadcast schedule has changed. We now air a portion of the Pulse the same day we update the podcasts on Fridays. You can listen for it during the 5:30 half hour of All Things Considered. Steve Missler writes a Maine's Political Pulse newsletter. You can read it at mainepublic.org or sign up to have it delivered to your email inbox each Friday morning. Willis Ryder Arnold produces the podcast. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. We'll be back in a week with another edition of Maine's Political Pulse.